Here's your host, Nick Lowry.
Welcome back. We're joined by Jim Beattie, two-time general manager, vice president with the Orioles. He's head of the farm system for the Seattle Mariners. He has been around the game and giving us an update. Really kind of a slow time, but I thought before we got to baseball and in this sort of lame duck period before things heat up, Jim, I thought I'd ask your reply or your response to Michael Strahan and his insight into the two-week delay, which can be difficult for those players and those coaches that are used to something every week.
But a lot of times, if you do have someone like a Rex Grossman or somebody who may not be that confident, and all for 2 weeks now he's going to hear about how they really don't think he's that good, sometimes it doesn't help your confidence going into the game. Sometimes players buy into the hype of what they're saying about one side or the other, and it does not help your confidence in that game. So I think whichever team can distance themselves from all the media fanfare, from getting caught up in the process of it, and who can just understand it, keep your head clear of the papers, stay clear of all this extra stuff that's now going to be thrown your way, and focus on what's at hand, that's going to be the team that handles the best and wins.
That's Michael Strahan. What is your insight into this and how you would prepare a team? One of the interesting things to me is when you look back at Detroit, which had that extra delay of a week, stuck up there in Detroit, it was kind of cold, and they came down and made four errors in four games. I mean, no one's ever seen anything like that. And the delay does end up being a potential huge barrier to the performance level.
Well, Nick, thanks for having me on. I think that what you're talking about is sometimes the result of kind of so-so Super Bowls. I mean, football players are used to playing every week. Baseball players are used to playing essentially every day. When you get even the All-Star break in baseball gets you out there, and when you come back, if you haven't thrown a baseball for 3 or 4 days and you're playing catch with someone, it's like a whole new game again because you're just conditioned to do it all the time. And I think that the quality of the game, the players, I think, would have to agree. Yeah, it's great. They can get everybody healthy. They can prepare. They can have the preparations as much as they want to understand what the other team is going to do for the Super Bowl. But the quality of the play, I think, has to suffer because they're not as sharp. They're not used to having, you know, whatever. You would know better than I what a football schedule is from week to week, but they probably only have two or three pretty hard practices, and the rest of them are just touch-and-feel type practices, getting loose and getting out there and running through some of the finer points of what they're doing by way of preparation. So I think the preparation coach way, by way of what they're thinking about for play preparation, defense, and so on, is very good. But I think the quality and the fine touch of the athletes, especially the receivers, the quarterbacks, and in some cases maybe even the linemen, they lose that contact. They lose some of their approach, and the better part of their skills, I think, are lost when you have a two-week delay like that.
What would you do, though, and of course, in football, because you're dealing with the injury factor being a very significant risk, and of course, Indianapolis in this case has Nick Harper with a high ankle sprain that you've probably seen in baseball, and that can sometimes take some time to recover. So in football, you're dealing with the fact that you want to go a team at full speed, and that's what a Pete Carroll would do with USC. His team seemed to be very aware of team speed in practice, so it's much easier for them. They seem to be a little faster in the games, and those pro coaches want usually to conduct practice at that fast pace. Now suddenly they're worried about injuries. What would you do? What would be some suggestions you do to how you would handle this extra week?
Well, I think you're right. You don't want to get anybody hurt in a practice for those 2 weeks. You have all those practices, and it's not like you can, yeah, I guess you probably give them a day or two off to relax and maybe come in and get some treatment, the guys that are hurt, but you have to be careful. And when you have to be careful and you're not playing at the same intensity, that's when a lot of guys will get hurt. They're trying to be extra careful. The same thing with baseball or any sport. I mean, if you're out there and you're not going at the speed you're used to going, whether you're going through layup drills, whether you're playing one-on-one, if you're going at something less than what you think is your optimum, then I think you give yourself a chance to get hurt because you're not quite quick enough, you're not reacting at the same speed. And I think football players in particular, with the type of the wear and the grind on their bodies throughout the year, I think they're happy to have the time off. But I think they trying to get back into it after 2 weeks, I think You have to take some chances. Otherwise, the team that you put out on the field won't be ready to play that game.
Well, let's get to baseball and the interesting things that are out there. Jeff Weaver has an interesting dilemma going back to either St. Louis or Pittsburgh with coaches he's played for. St. Louis, I would think he'd want to go back to St. Louis just because of the magic that they created there.
Well, you know, Jeff Weaver is, I think, an enigma for a lot of teams. I mean, they've seen him fail. They've seen him when he was a young player coming up with Detroit, pitching very well, going to New York with the Yankees and really just not playing well at all. Then going to L.A., and the L.A. coaching staff, Jim Tracy, Jim Colburn, are now the pitching coach and the manager with Pittsburgh. He pitched well in L.A., not outstanding, but he pitched well enough, gave them a lot of innings each year, and pitched had a very fine effort there. Coming off that, signed a one-year deal with the Angels, did not pitch well with the Angels. They traded him to St. Louis, and St. Louis, with Dave Duncan, who I had as a pitching coach. If you have physical ability, Dave Duncan will bring it out of you because he will work with the mental side and your approach, your strategy when you go out there to pitch. And that's what he did, I believe, with Jeff Weaver. If I were Jeff Weaver and I was taking a look at those things, who I was going to be working with would be very important and my comfort level. And I would say whether it would be with Pittsburgh and his comfort level with Jim Colburn and Jim Tracy or with Tony La Russa and Dave Duncan. Now, he just had the success with St. Louis. And to be able to go back there and feel more comfortable, I think, would be a big plus on his side to continue his effectiveness and maybe build a couple of years with the same club. I think that's what players should be looking to try to do.
You know, that's what I counsel guys in any sport is that when you're set up for success, I don't care if it's an extra $1 million, there's a lot of value in being in a place where you're set up for success long term. A player that's consistent year in, year out is going to be paid as much or more anyway, and the quality of life is a very, very different factor. Final question is, Bernie Williams, is he going to come back to the Yankees?
Well, that is a dilemma in the sport these days. There are very, very few players that have played with their team, especially in baseball, for their entire career, one team. And Bernie has done that. Now, the Yankees, in trying to improve, even last year he came back, and he was a fourth outfielder, but because Matsui got hurt and he had a lot of time, it ended up being that Bernie got a lot of chance to play and played well. I mean, he was not Bernie Williams of old, but he played well. You'd like to think that Bernie Williams is going to be a Yankee for his entire career, but if he signed on with them right now, he's going to probably be a fifth outfielder. Come in the middle of the season when they might need some roster flexibility, and Bernie isn't playing that much, they've got their outfield all set. Are they going to end up having to release Bernie Williams in the middle of the season? Is that going to be a good situation for them? I don't think so. I think they're trying to deal with it now, but you can't blame a guy for wanting to keep on playing. It's a lot of fun out there for him at this stage of his career. If he's healthy, I don't blame him. So it is a touchy situation and one that has to be dealt with the idea that Bernie Williams is a Yankee and really should stay a Yankee.
Yeah, when you look at Cal Ripken, his entire career, and what a difference that makes for Hall of Fame potential as well, but also just the fact that if I had to do it over again, I'm man enough to admit that I wish I had stayed my entire career in Kansas City and not had those 3 years not with them, because it just changes your whole sense of what it was about. But thanks for joining us, Jim, as always. We'll check in with you next week, buddy.
You bet, Nick. Have a great day.
Thank you, sir. Okay, it's wake-up time down under. We are now flying together over the Pacific Ocean, flying into the hotel room of Luke Jensen, the man who is bringing the best tennis in the world to us. How are you, buddy?
You're telling me that you would have turned down the New York Jets in that franchise at the time that was rebuilding with Ronnie Lott? No way!
Hey, buddy, I look back at what happened with Richie Kotite. Are you kidding me?
Hey, come on, man. I don't know.
Hey, Ronnie Lott's great. Boomer Esiason's great. There were some wonderful people on that team, but ultimately you got to be in a place where you're set up for success. Now let's talk about that. We thought that Andy Roddick, you thought yesterday Andy Roddick had that level of belief. That was my last question to you. But I guess the proof is, just like with Tiger Woods, when Tiger brings his A game, forget it. No one else can compete. When Roger Federer brings his A game like he did yesterday, it's lights out.
Yeah, I've had to eat a lot of crow over the last, 24 hours or so. No, that's fine. I mean, to me, it's crushing in one sense if you're Andy Roddick. This isn't a guy that just walked into this match and said, you know what, I'm ready to play. He's done everything possible to try to succeed at this level against this guy. He hired Jimmy Connors. He's revamped his game plan. He's attacking more. He's worked so hard. He traveled all over the place to get the best practice. He spent a month in Hawaii just to get used to conditions on the surface, the heat, humidity, everything possible to prepare for this match. And then, you know, he has match points at the Masters Cup. He beats this guy in an exhibition. So all of a sudden, everything in the cards is saying, I'm ready to compete now for this match. And he goes out there, and he gets broken in the very first game. And outside of a little shaky play for Roger Federer, it was a beatdown. And we've all been there. We've all been there where we've gotten the garbage kicked out of us. And like you said, a guy with superior weapons, speed, everything, just comes with his A game and just embarrasses you.
Well, let's look at what were the specifics of it, because I believed that Andy's serve was something we could take for granted. But it looks as if, even as much as Andy has been depending on Jimmy Connors to develop an all-round game, maybe Roger has worked on that one key component still and completely neutralized Roddick's serve.
Well, the reason the guy's 13-1 lifetime over Andy Roddick is that Roger Federer does one thing no one else can do. Most the tour average of against Andy Roddick, just getting his serve back, just back in play, is about 38%. 38% of the time, they put Andy Roddick's serve back in play because it is so devastating. Again, Roger Federer can do it over 70% of the time. He's taken the biggest serve in the history of the game, the world record fastest serve, and putting it back time and time again. And that kills you as an opponent. If you're Roger Federer and you're just blocking it back, you're rolling it back, you're getting it back in play, Andy Roddick has to work so hard on that end. And that's one key aspect, is that Roger Federer is faster, he's steadier, and he neutralizes the biggest weapon in Andy Roddick's game plan.
And let's make sure, I believe it's really not as if Andy played so much poorly. It really is that Federer took his game to a new level that almost no one else has ever achieved.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. And he has to, you know, Andy Roddick now has to go back to the drawing board. And being this close to the action, I've played up here. You have got to revamp your game plan. The only way Andy Roddick's going to beat Roger Federer is by getting faster. He's got to get quicker. He's got to be able to stay with this guy with the footwork, or he's never going to beat him.
He's got that balance. Federer has that incredible nimble balance. You know what it reminds me of, Luke? It reminds me of Tom Brady, who, with a pass rush on him, with guys coming from left and right and up the middle, seems to always throw with absolute perfect form and deft touch, with the exception of that last interception. Even on that last drive, it was just it's a beautiful thing to watch.
Same with Joe Montana. Guys getting in the zone.
Well, listen, we're going to go back to that advertising zone for a couple minutes. But when we come back, let's talk about Serena and a woman that continues to play serenely at the Australian Open, with Luke Jensen down under on Sports Byline and Sirius Channel 122.